Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host, and it's the 14th season of Heritage Radio Network and Beer Sessions Radio. Wow, we've got some good friends out in Colorado, and we're going to talk to them today. What I love about doing the online shows like we're doing now is that there's a guy out in Littleton, Colorado that's going to be talking to us about his brewery. So let's go around the room and you guys introduce yourself. Start with Jason.
Yeah, my name's Jason Bell, and I'm the founder and owner of Living the Dream Brewing in Littleton, Colorado.
That's amazing. I just love it. I was out in Denver this spring, and I just love, getting to talk to you guys, and, so cool. And Em?
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily Hutto. I'm the founder at Radcraft, and I'm a proud spokesperson for Living the Dream Brewing.
All right. So, Emily, I got to hang out with you a little bit through a lot of your clients at the Bowl of Zol, the Pozole and Mezcal Fest back in March out in Denver. It was my first time in Denver. And one thing about Denver and Littleton, that whole area, the lifestyle's great, the beer's great, the food, the IQ of not just the industry, but also the consumers is really high. And I guess it's probably one of my favorite places to go now. Jason, why don't you tell us on that note? I know it's your 9th anniversary just happened at your brewery. Why don't you tell us about how you got started, a little bit about, what you think of the industry there in Littleton and greater Denver area, and, your passions for beer and having a brewery.
Sure. As you said, we just had our 9th birthday. We opened in 2014. My path here is a little bit varied, although most brewery owners will tell you we all came from something else, as did I. My background was in food. I was a chef for a number of years, then moved into restaurant and bar management and beverage management, and then moved into wine and spirits liquor retail. And that's about the same time craft beer started coming on real strong. I was in this, that point I was in Chicago, Illinois, and running liquor stores. And that was the same time that a little brewery out here called New Belgium shipped the first bottles of Fat Tire east of the Mississippi legally and sold them. So it kind of caught my eye, and I got into it and picked up home brewing as my wife told me to get a hobby. And I'm not really sure if she really thought this is what's going to happen, but started homebrewing and kind of grew it and decided this is what we wanted to do, and moved out here and spent about a year getting ready and then opened the doors. As for you hit it on the head with the clientele and the customer base out here, which is a lot of the reason we wanted to do it here. It's a little bit like if we can make it there, because the clientele, the customers are so savvy. They understand beer. It's part of the culture. It's deeply embedded in the culture. It's what people do. They hang out at breweries. They hang out in tap rooms. That's where they meet. And getting to be a provider of that, as well as you become part of the community, has really been the crux of what we do.
That's great. Great intro, man. So, when you first started, what was the setup like? Was the tap room an important part of this? Were you just making beer and selling the beer?
Yeah, when we opened, we opened just with a tap room. It was about 6 or 8 months later. We started to, you know, sell a kegger to some local restaurants that were interested. And it was probably another 6-8 months. We began packaging beer through mobile canning, and just kind of learned from there. We started on a small 7-barrel system that was completely manual. I know our first brew days were 13, 14 hours for a single batch, which, you know, you always look back and kind of laugh at what we didn't know.
Well, it's a great way to start, man. You know, what were some of the first beers that you made that you remember, and do you still make those?
I do remember, somewhat painfully, but no, I do remember. a couple of them have survived. None are in our main rotation anymore, and a few of them are gone completely or have evolved into something else. You know, we tried to start with a pretty good spectrum of different styles. I know we started with an IPA. We started with a double IPA, single IPA, dry stout. We worked our way into our first lager. What else? We started with a Belgian wit that is no longer made. And I think that is about it. I think we started with 5.
Wow. Out there now in where you are in Colorado, what's the number one style of beer that people drink at tap rooms? Or is it different at different places?
Definitely different at different places. Our flagship is, we developed a cream ale called Powder Run. That is a cream ale that we add pure vanilla to and a little bit of lactose. So it kind of drinks like a dry cream soda. It's kind of the beer that put us on the map outside of our you know, immediate neighborhood area, but it's still our best seller, but overall style wise, it's still IPA.
It's cool, man. And what are some of your thoughts about this brewery? Because I mean, you've got a lot of different ones. There's so many breweries in the country right now, but each place is unique. Each place is special. And the on-premise experience is really what I'm excited about. I feel like everyone's got tap rooms can always be better, and there's nothing like a great tap room.
I could not agree more with you, Jimmy. I have always loved Living the Dream Brewing since they started. For one, because it's located in my hometown. So I tend to be surrounded by friends and family when I'm in Littleton. And that's the vibe at Living the Dream always, whether or not I bring my friends or I just make friends. And it's the people there that I think really make the difference for me. I've always gotten exceptional customer service, and I'll use your term high beer IQ among their staff. And I also really love Living the Dream. Well, I mean, beer first, right? I wouldn't work with a brewery that wasn't making really wonderful, tell everybody about it, beer, because that's why we're all here. But then they augment the experience with all of these wonderful people and this really comfortable tasting room. And I think they like dogs in Living the Dream just as much as, or if not more than humans. And so my fur baby has always been quite welcome there. And for that, I really appreciate them.
That's cool. Jason, so let's talk more about your tap room, just because I really am, like, especially after the pandemic, I'm talking to a lot more breweries about what's happening in their tap room and whether they're doing cask ale on the East Coast or trying out, you know, side pulls to do Czech lagers. You know, is there a vision for your tap room now, or is it just like evolved? And, you know, what is it that you like about your tap room? Like, because sometimes it's like, I just want to go to a certain place because there's something about it that just does it right.
Yeah, I would say first and foremost, the thing I like about my tap room is our team. I am incredibly fortunate to have wonderful people working with me. You know, I don't try to do everything. I've got enough to do. And every one of them, we've got people that have been with us pretty much since we opened. And, you know, first and foremost, they make the experience. Our tap room is not what you would call plush. It's pretty rustic. We're in an industrial building with a roll-up door. And that's what people kind of like, especially down here in the suburbs. It's a little bit kind of, you know, that kind of industrial rustic feel. You're kind of getting away, but you know, it's just comfortable. It's got that feel where there's a really good chance one of the bartenders knows who you are. If they don't, they will get to know you pretty fast, as Emily was talking about. We didn't really, evolution for us has been just keep getting better at what we do. We do some events, but we don't do live music. We're not a sports bar. And we haven't thrown a bunch of stuff against the wall to see what sticks. We've just become a place that people know and feel at home at and can relax and have a great beer, hopefully, and a great time. Our theme is just Colorado. It's the outdoors. Our whole front of our bar is lined with skis, old skis. We theme it just to make people feel good about being here, not to, you know, impose some sort of experience other than just enjoyment.
Wow, that's really cool. I know you had this quote, said you're inspired by the Thoreau quote.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the quote, or am I putting you on the stump?
Oh, no. Go forth in the direction of your dreams and live the life you've imagined. I know it well. Write it a lot. It's funny when we found that, it just fits. We found that after we named everything and kind of came up with everything. And it just was like, holy cow, this fits so well to not just what we're doing, living our dream of creating this business, but just, you know, go after it. It's the world's out there. Go experience it. Chase your dreams, because that's the only way they come true.
You know, the fact that you use a Thoreau quote puts you in a very high drinking IQ group. Because I have a friend from the East Coast. He's a cider maker and author, and he always quotes Thoreau. He's more into apples, but I'm smiling because of it. I think M must be smiling too. More of your inspirations, man, because like you seem like a thoughtful guy. And food and beverage, you know, when did you know that that was your thing? Because you worked in it a long time.
I knew pretty early. Funny enough, I always was into it. At a young age, I started just getting into cooking and food. And unfortunately, I took a side trip and studied engineering in college for 3.5 years, thinking that's, you know, that's a career. Food's fun. And finally decided to pursue it full time, and left school for a while and apprenticed in a hotel and learned. But it was a pretty early age of that. That was where my interest was. And I've kind of, it kind of evolved to not just about food, but flavor. I really enjoy flavor combinations and the way things, you know, you react to different flavors. And that's how it kind of tied into the beer side as well. And we try to use that kind of passion when we brew or when we come up with new beers. So it was pretty early for me. It was probably 8, 9, 10. I probably got started getting into it. Somewhere around there.
Oh, yeah. So, changing subjects back to just Colorado and the state. I know in different states, there's different rules and regulations for tap rooms and how you can operate. Like I know in New Jersey, there's a big push now to change some of the tap room laws, because a lot of the breweries have their hands tied behind their back. But in other states like New York, it's really gotten a lot more progressive. What can you do in your tap room? I mean, do you have to have food? Can you bring in food? Can you have events?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons there's so many breweries in Colorado. The state is very friendly. Some municipalities may have some more strict rules, but not a lot. I think they've realized very quickly that it is such a revenue generator for the governments and and it's just what people want. We don't really have a lot of restrictions. Other than the standards of, you know, people can't bring in their own alcohol. We're not allowed to serve, because we operate under a manufacturing license. We're not a brew pub. We don't do food. I can't serve, you know, wine or any other or spirits or anything. We can, through a lot of hassle, but doable, serve other breweries, Colorado breweries, beer. You know, for collaborating with somebody, it works really well. But overall, events are fine. People can bring their own food in. We do food trucks. We rotate probably 35 different food trucks, and we have them every night, 7 days a week. It's very, very friendly to operating, you know, a tap room and a brewery in Colorado, which is probably, you know, a big part of the reason why it's so popular here.
Wow. What are some of the food trucks that you yourself like?
Oh, wow. We have such a wide variety, and everything from, there's a great truck that does authentic, like Austrian schnitzel, to we had a wonderful Detroit pizza truck that was here this weekend. Lot of taco trucks, some wings. And there's some that are pretty cool that get pretty creative with the food, and they're probably some of my favorites. I would say my favorites fall into two categories. Either, you know, they specialize in something and they just do it really well, and I would put the pizza truck and the schnitzel truck in that category, or trucks that they have a lot of creativity. And we used to have a truck that changed the menu every month, and it was, you know, based on the season and that kind of thing. And we've also over time kind of set standards for what we expect. So, you know, we rarely get a truck that isn't pretty outstanding.
Yeah. Hey, you know, talking about tap rooms and service, I came up more through the restaurant industry, and I always think about there's a bar for, you know, getting your drinks or even eating. And when you sit, I always like table service. But I'm coming around to taproom life. I just read an article about I'm up in the Boston area these days, and a couple of breweries that have a outdoor beer garden, and just how important that is for people to socialize. I want to hear your thoughts on what a good taproom is and the social experience.
I think the interaction level should be as much or as little as the consumer wants. You know, if they want to sit at the bar and, you know, talk, get to know the bartender and have them get to know them, fantastic. You know, if they're meeting somebody or it's a family get together or whatever, and they just want to get their beers and have their space, they should be able to do that too. You know, it's when we try to impose what we think they should do, I think that's when you run into trouble. And that again falls back to our staff, just being able to read the customer and react and not feel bad if they're not chatty, but certainly they're, you know, wonderfully social people who will definitely get to know you if that's what you desire. I think that's the big key, is just having the option and letting the consumer you know, guide the process, so to speak.
And then M mentioned dogs. How do you read dogs? I mean,
well, I think our staff holds world records for number of dogs petted in a year. But, you know, it's a lot of that over time. To be honest, you do have to train your customers a little bit. And we have to set, you know, you got to be on a leash. They got to be well behaved. And over time, very quickly, you know, people don't want to be that guy with the aggressive dog or whatever. So a lot of people bring their dogs here, and that's how they socialize them. You know, they know we have a setup for water, so they can get bowls of water whenever they need it. Certainly right now it's very warm. Things like that. We have dog treats behind the bar, and we actually, as part of our marketing efforts that Emily works so well with, we do a dog of the month who gets, you know, on our social media, and their owners get discounts for the month, and it's amazing the response. But people out here, again, just like the beer, people out here love dogs. I mean, I have one, Emily has one. I would say at least 60% of my staff have dogs. You know, so it's all part of it as well. It's just all part of that Colorado life.
Em, do you want to add anything for the dogs?
I will say it's worth a follow at Living Dream Brew on Instagram so that you can see all these pups.
Wow. I love that. Hey, talking about cans and things, are you distributing outside? So you mentioned when you started, you did a little distributing. Mm-hmm. What are you doing now? Are you distributing statewide?
Yes. We were distributing up until a little, just about 14 months ago, we were just self-distributing on the Front Range, meaning basically Wyoming south to Colorado Springs, which includes Denver and Littleton. And but it was just us doing it, our own truck going out. A little over a year ago, we signed with Colorado Craft Distributors here in Denver, and now they are distributing us throughout the whole state.
That's great, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you just depend on them to do the sales, or do you guys have to go out and do you go to other towns or sure. or stores to support?
We had, before we signed, we had two sales reps, and we kept them. Now they're kind of our brand managers. So their whole job is to support Colorado Craft and their sales reps, which I think they have 14 or 15. You got to keep your brand relevant. You know, I learned this from running liquor stores. We would get brands from out of state, you know, including Colorado when I was in Chicago. And if they didn't support them, why is the distributor going to care? You know, so it's always been important that we support, and our two guys are out every day, either setting up special events or, you know, beer of the month kind of things, or just working alongside the distribution sales reps. So it's a necessity. You can't just, you know, clap your hands and hope they take care of it. You've got to really stay on them. Not that they don't care. It's just, they have however many other brands, you know, they have to. So our job is to stay relevant in their minds and in the accounts that we are in.
Oh yeah. You got so many. You know how it is. You get that one good rep, and suddenly you're moving a lot of their beer.
Exactly.
More about distribution. It might be controversial. I don't think it's controversial because I'm a big supporter of small craft breweries. But I remember a few years back, I had a conversation about, like, every state is different about their wine and liquor stores. And I remember that one of the your legendary brewers said that one reason Colorado craft beer took off was because of the indie liquor wine stores. Tell me more about that. And it seems like a uniquely Colorado thing, because I know in New York we have New York State. There's the independent wine stores are the only place you can buy wine or liquor, but not beer.
Well, that's evolved here too. That was very true. And so you could guarantee that every corner strip mall with a grocery store also had a liquor store. The problem with that is that, you know, you get a lot of small little shops, and it's hard to service them all. And some are definitely better than others. And there's some really good ones out there. What has evolved here is now grocery stores can carry full strength beer. We were famous for the 3-2 law, where grocery stores could only carry 3-2 beer, which, you know, is a bit, we call it why bother beer, but, you know, and that's pretty much gone because the liquor stores are now have gone full strength. There was a lot of rules about you could own for the longest time, even as a liquor store owner, you could only own one. Any liquor store retail license was just limited to one per owner. That's begun to evolve. You know, it's good and bad for sure. It's nice to see some larger companies come in who can offer selection and service, you know, and I came from a company like that in Chicago. We had, I think they're up to 40 stores now. But you also don't want to rule out the independent, you know, you really want to make sure, we've made the decision. We are not in the grocery stores, in the big chain grocery stores, other than I think we're in Whole Foods. I think that's the only one. But they have such a commitment to local that, you know, it's worth it. But the big stores are, and what we see is the big grocery stores are selling the really big craft beers, and you could almost put craft in quotes for those, you know, and it's fine. I don't think it's hurt us. I think it's actually, it helps us a little bit to say, no, we're not in those places. So when we are introduced to a new liquor, smaller liquor store, you know, they're more interested in our product for that reason. But yeah, it's a slow evolution, which I think is probably smarter than, you know, a quick change, which is something that was kind of attempted with some ballot measures, but luckily they found a compromise that I think is working. But it's going to be a multi-year process.
Yeah. And talking about, you know, Colorado, that you as your governor and Senator John Hickenlooper, I don't know if it's okay to talk about him, but how important was he to the evolution of Colorado craft beer?
I think for the simplest way to put it is he kept the government kind of out of the way when it came to breweries. You know, he was a big part of it with WinCoop, and as he kind of rose up the ranks, you know, he's mayor of Denver and then he was governor and now senator. He has always done a good job of keeping it, you know, very friendly for craft breweries, and we haven't seen a lot of, I'm having a hard time thinking of any major regulations changes that have affected us. You know, and it's, I don't know specifically exactly what he did. He was already, he was just leaving the governorship, I think, when I moved here, or was at the tail end. But always been, he met him a couple times, super nice guy, and very, very much, you know, involved and supportive of the industry, and wants to keep the state at kind of the forefront of the industry. So it's, you know, absolutely hats off to him.
Wow, that's really cool. I've heard a lot about him. Never been to WinCoop, but I know that for a long time he was talked about as an important person in your state. So,
yep.
Thank you for talking about that.
Yeah.
You know, for you, Littleton, you know, there's something about Colorado. I know the Brewers Association's there, and I'm just an East Coast guy, so it might sound like an idiot to you guys. But I think that for a lot of our listeners, it's fascinating to meet you and hear about you. Tell us more about Littleton. So, you know, you're in an industrial kind of style brewery.
Right.
You know, do people drive to you? Do they walk? Do they bike? You know, where do you eat in your town besides the food trucks? Just tell us a little bit about the local flavor.
So we're in this kind of interesting spot. Our address is Littleton. We're not officially in Littleton. We're in an unincorporated area that sits between Littleton and another unincorporated community called Highlands Ranch. Highlands Ranch is probably our biggest area of draw, and it's a fascinating place in that it's one of the largest unincorporated communities in the country. I think it's over 100,000 people, and it's not a city. There is no mayor. It is run by a community association. It is ultimate suburbia. And I don't say that in necessarily a bad way, because I actually live in Highlands Ranch. But we are on the edge of that and the edge of Littleton, and we pull a lot from both. And then there's another two more little sleepy communities to our south. So we're kind of in this middle area, in this island of industrial around suburbia, I guess I would call it. Although to our west, we're not far from the mountains and a really great reservoir lake that is open to the public called Chatfield. But it's really kind of this odd thing where we're not close enough that people can walk to residential. We do get a ton of people who bike, and there are many, many miles of trails. And that's one of the things, again, that's part of that Colorado lifestyle. But I think in Highlands Ranch, there's over 100 miles of bike trails, and there's a ton of Littleton.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And there's some that run along the rivers. There's a Highline Canal Trail that runs all over Denver. And it's literally almost right behind the brewery. So we get a ton of people biking. We've had people show up in horses. you know, you never know. It's interesting. It's an interesting area, but otherwise, I mean, there's a lot of cool, there's a lot of great places to eat and stuff. There's a lot of local, of course, a lot of chains too, but, you know, Mexican food is very big here. Green chili is king in that area, you know, between the Colorado Pueblo chilies and then the New Mexico Hatch chilies. That's a big deal every year. We do a beer with Hatch chilies in it. A lot of pizza. There's a lot of everything. There's a lot of good ethnic food. My wife is from the UK, so she has to find good Indian food and has, you know, there's just whatever you want. It's here. And I, moving here from Chicago, it's easier to get to things, you know. Living in a city like Chicago, if you wanted to go three towns over, it was the whole evening just to get there and get back. And here you can travel around a little bit. We've got these great historic places, the Fort, Buckhorn Exchange. You know, I'm sure I'm missing some stuff, but it's just whatever you want. It's here.
So you're in that ideal place. I read recently that the ideal commute is 30 minutes.
Yeah,
if you're any further than that, your quality of life suffers. So,
although I have been to Boston, and you got some pretty great food there too. So,
well, we'll talk East Coast later. But in New York, you can take a subway, but ideally you can walk somewhere. But it's not like where you guys are. I'm kind of enamored with the whole Denver area right now. So, and that's all M's fault. So. Em, you know, we're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome to heritageradionetwork.org. Support us, become a member, heritageradionetwork.org. So we got Jason Bell, Living the Dream Brewery in Littleton, Colorado, and Em Hudo, our good friend from Radcraft Beer. So Em, you got this client. We can talk about it because you're a big part of how the beer world works. I got to meet a lot of your clients at the Craft Malt Conference. I've talked to friends of yours in Durango. I met Emporium Brewing when I was in Denver. What's the magic of Radcraft? Because the one thing I would say is all your clients are worthy and they make good beer.
That's a really lovely question. Thank you. I think 10 years in business, and it's funny, the more I spend in time in business, the less I know. But I think really it's just a matter of the people who are involved. I have this company slogan that's good beer made by better people. And there's some secret sauce in finding humans who really care about their communities, really care about the people who work at their businesses and who are doing something that matters to them. And I think when business is fueled by passion, it just makes it that much more authentic and exciting to be a part of. Specifically related to Living the Dream, I mean, it's clear that Jason is a man with a lot of passion and who has built a brewery and a company and a brand around these elements of life that he really cares about. One of those things it's a base camp for adventure. And I know a lot of companies say that, but you can literally sit on the Living the Dream patio and look at the Front Range and look at the Rocky Mountain Range and just know that you're in the heart of Colorado with opportunities endlessly in front of you. Another thing Jason really cares about is quality of ingredients. I know that comes from his chef background, but all of the different flavors that you can taste in Living the Dream beers are naturally derived ingredients. So he's not interested in putting fake stuff in there. And I think that really makes a difference in what you can taste, and also just the overall mission of intentionality and doing things in ways that matter to him.
No, that's great. So Jason, let's talk more about your beers and beer styles. You won 2 gold medals recently for the U.S. Beer Open for Rocker Spirits, Bourbon Barrel Age Imperial Stout, and the Horchata Powder Run variation on your cream ale. You want to talk about the beers, just the process, and are you the brewer? Do you have a brewer now?
Yeah, when we started, I was the brewer, and I brewed pretty much everything. And as the business grew and our structure kind of evolved, I knowingly stepped away from the brewing. I mean, I knew it was going to happen, and I'm okay with it. Now we've had a couple of head brewers. Tim was one of our more recent ones who started with us in the beginning and grew, came up through the ranks. And then he let me know about a year in advance that he was going to be returning to his home in Florida for family. And he's now running a brew pub down there quite well. And then we brought in Rob Meehan at that point, and he's been the head brewer for almost 2 years, or about a year and a half, I think. Rob came from the East Coast. He from New York originally, but we found him in Raleigh, North Carolina. He was the head brewer for a brewery called Pony Source for a while, and then was kind of taking on a large brew pub project. But like many of us in this industry, his wife got a job that was good enough that he had to kind of go with her, and that job was out here, and the timing worked out. And you know, and it works out well for us that what I really liked about Rob is he's got 3 or 4 advanced degrees, but did not come in with an attitude of, you know, I'll show you how it's done. You know, it was more, I want to learn how you guys have gotten this far, and then let's see what we can do to make it better. And that's the approach he has had in both taking on the brewing operations as well as training. We have 2 other full-time brewers. So it's nice that I'm comfortable handing, you know, I still am involved and we discuss a lot. And I still have some of the ideas. It's probably about 50-50 now, where before I probably had 85-90% of the beer ideas. But he completely subscribes to a lot of the philosophy I have regarding quality and, you know, let's not do any shortcuts. Let's really make the best beer we can. And so that's worked out quite well. And I will add, going back to your question about Radcraft and Emily, I think, you know, she is the key to it. But I also think part of that is not just her enthusiasm and honesty and just how much she becomes a part of your team, but she came from the beer ranks. She's not an advertising or marketing person who decided to learn about beer. She came up through the ranks in breweries learning just like the rest of us. So I think that's the big key. And that's why us and her other clients, who I know a number of them, have so much faith and enjoy working with her so much. So I wanted to give that little plug, but you know, it's been a neat industry that, although it's competitive, there's so much collaborative aspect to it. And you know, and then you mentioned us winning a couple of medals, the U.S. Beer Open. That's just kind of, to us, that's kind of gravy on top. But, you know, I said we just had probably 1,000 of our good friends as customers in over the weekend for our anniversary. And that that's really the awards for us, is when people just enjoy what we're doing.
Oh, that's great. Well, it does sound interesting. So rock or spirits, it, with your new brewer, is he driving like innovations or, you know, new beers that you're releasing?
Yes and no. He is very, he's very science driven, which I really like, because it's a nice offset to me with the culinary side. Rob has a PhD in chemistry from Yale. I mean, he lives it. And, you know, of course, my first interview question is, why the hell are you brewing? And he just loves it. It's what he does. So
you answer my question too. I was going to say, what degrees does he have? And I was wondering.
Yeah, that's one of them. But he doesn't, as he says, he only uses his degrees for good. But it's, you know, it's a really nice collaborative effort, as well as our other two brewers have come in. We just released a beer for the anniversary that I got to plug it, because Teddy is one of our full-time brewers. And it was his concept and his recipe. And the reason I have to plug it is because he's also my son. So that's pretty cool that I get another generation. And he has earned everything he has gotten here. He gets no special pass, but it's really neat to see something he did, or David or other brewer did, or Rob or anybody, you know, not just to see it do well, but to see them see it do well. You know, when they create something and people really enjoy it, that's pretty cool. So it's, you know, it's really, our innovation is in baby steps. And, you know, one key rule in brewing is change one variable at a time, because if you change three things at once, you don't know which one worked. And we're fortunate that we brew a lot. We brew probably 4 or 5 times a week, so at least, so we're able to, you know, track and monitor and see what works and what improves. And we're always looking to improve, but it's, especially when you're a distributing brewery, you know, you can't just say, okay, we're just going to do this beer completely different now, because that's just not going to work.
Wow. So just giving credit to your son, first of all, it's great that you seem like you're kind of growing this as a family business, but what's the beer that he made that you're so proud of?
It's a cranberry lime blonde that we released for the anniversary party. And part of what, and I say this, and I'm not really a cranberry fan, so I'm not going to be the guy that waxes poetically how it's in this amazing beer, everyone should try it. But what I can say is cranberry and lime are so different in their flavor intensities. And he got the balance just spot on, to where it's almost like neither one dominates, but you can tell they're both there, and that's pretty cool. You know, that took a lot of probably a little luck, but a lot of work on his part. So that's why I think it was, and it was really well received, which is also very, very cool to see.
Well, looking at your beer styles, you know, I was actually just talking about Goza, because I remember when Goza came out of nowhere in 2015, and the New York Times wrote about it, but. Who drives the styles? Is it a tap room with customers being open to different styles? Like, how many styles do you usually have on in the tap room? And does one of the brewers just say, hey, can we just try, you know, is there a green light that's needed to make a different style of beer? How about that?
There is. There's a lot of factors, starting with when can we fit it in the schedule is one. We definitely have discussions of, will it sell? You know, what's the thought process? What are we going for? And honestly, most of them become kind of collaborative at that point, where, you know, well, what if we did this, or what if we did that? And 10 times out of 10, it's a better result than one guy, you know, or one person just coming up with something. But it's also a business, and that's kind of where I get involved, and so does Rob, but, you know, it's got to be economically feasible. It can't just be, you know, it can't be priced at a point where you got to charge, you know, $20 for 8 ounces or whatever, some outrageous number. And especially if we're going to push it into distribution, you know, and we get feedback from customers too. Some of it's been really good. Some of it, you listen and nod and smile and move on. But, you know, you take wherever you can get it. And because sometimes, you know, you may have not thought of something and all of a sudden, hey, that worked, you know.
So, and how many different styles do you usually have on in the tap room at one time?
We have 14 taps. So pretty much they're always full, you know, and the schedule gets hard because we are distributing statewide. And so you can't run out of some of those, you know, the stuff we put in the cans, especially Powder Runner, bestseller, that, you know, those things kind of have to take precedence a little bit. And we operate on a 15 barrel brew house and we don't have a pilot system. So we are kind of running and gunning as we go. And luckily through sheer repetition, we kind of have a good idea of what works, at least from the brewing process. So we kind of have an idea of how it's going to work. But, you know, if we're developing something new, say like Horchata Powder Run, which is our Powder Run vanilla cream ale, and then we add cinnamon, you know, it takes a couple. We're not just going to brew it and can it. We have to kind of work through. We want to make sure it's good, it's stable, and all that kind of fun stuff, especially when you use fermentables, whether it's fruit or honey or anything else. You know, is the last thing you want is exploding cans. Retailers really, really are not fans of that when the cans blow up on the shelf. So either are consumers for that matter. But so we like to, you know, something will go through a process where we'll discuss it in depth and then we'll brew it and see what we think. And we decide, does it have potential to keep brewing it? And is this something that we want to push into the mainstream market that we're in? So it's a longer process. You know, it's not, as you get bigger, you can't just, hey, let's make this week. You know, you just can't do that.
Wow. Hey, back to your brewer with the PhD in chemistry. I love that. No, I think M has been leading us to talk about high beer IQ. I guess he has a high beer IQ. But you mentioned changing one thing at a time when you're tinkering with recipes and beer. Mm-hmm. With his interest in chemistry, has he done anything or talked about or changed any of your yeasts?
Yes, all of them. we've changed supplier and which is the all of them. But yeah, we've always kind of played with different yeasts. And you know, one thing as a home brewer, I never attempted and kind of saw it as this black magic thing, what was harvesting and repitching and all that stuff. Cause when you're a home brewer, you buy a $6 slant of White Labs and go, maybe make a starter. And, you know, there's no, you're spending more in stuff to repitch than you are in just another getting a new one. But, you know, now our pitches of yeast are in the $800-$900 range. So he took what we were already doing with regards to yeast handling and just grew on it and understood it more. And you know, we're cell counting, we're doing all that fun stuff. And because of his knowledge, you know, we've been able to extend our yeast generations from probably 6 or 7 to 13 or 14. So that makes a huge difference, both in the economics, because I'm not having to buy yeast as much, but also in the quality of the yeast, because it's really just, you know, it gets stronger. We've got a much wider window of really, really good yeast and strong fermentations that we didn't have as good. You know, we might have gotten 4 or 5 and now we're getting 8 or 9. And then also with the Goza we were talking about, he's been hugely instrumental in shaping that part of the project. And we now buy smaller pitches of different bacteria, and then he's able to prop them up and grow them in an environment that we won't infect anything else. And so yeah, it's been a very, that area is probably the biggest impact, and that, and he's a very data driven, tracks everything, which I love. So those two areas, and it's kind of nice because he likes to focus on those, which is what we needed. And I can still focus on, hey, I think these flavors go well together, you know, or let's really try to push this style a little bit. And he agrees with me also that we didn't mention is that all of our beers do start with a style. We don't just create a beer that's, you know, style is important to me. And discussing all the creativity, I really am happy to see some classic styles starting to come back in popularity. We were never the brewery that was, you know, melting ice cream or dumping cakes into the mash tun. We, you know, that just isn't how I wanted it to be. And especially with our lager program, we've been able to also focus on just brewing some great just beers that people know and stylistically as best we can.
Oh, that's great. Hey, just back to this yeast and flavor. So in your working with your brewer, are you better able to identify like certain flavors? How does it work with yeast and flavors? That's what I want to know is what's the relationship and how has it evolved with your new brewer?
It's partially flavor. And that's going to be more true with things like Belgian yeast, some lager yeast for sure. You know, the most popular yeast is White Labs 001, Cal Ale, which is the Chico, also known as Sierra Nevada yeast, which is very, very clean. It's not a yeast that's going to impart flavors. It's just a clean fermentation to let the other flavors through. So it really depends. Some yeast you're looking for flavor, especially Belgians. You let them run a little hotter, so they throw off more fusel alcohols and different flavors. And his knowledge of those is, you know, I was doing it based on, you know, I would read and understand, okay, this flavor when it gets hotter and this flavor, and, you know, he understands the actual processes of what the fusel alcohols and all the different esters are. And so he's just dialing it into another level, and it just does nothing but help us. And I know there's, as we grow, there's more coming because he has a much better understanding of the quality control aspects, you know, whether it's plating and looking at different beer spoilers and that stuff, which, you know, we just try to avoid. But what he needs to do what he needs to make that happen is, unfortunately, equipment that's a little out of our scope in cost due to cost at this point, but hopefully we'll get there and he can continue to grow it. But, you know, he just really understands when you understand it as deep as he does, what we're doing becomes kind of simple to him. So it's easier for him to lock in on it and just to do it. You know, consistency is the key in trying to make every batch, especially when you're distributing and sending it out there, people, you know, want the same beer. They want the beer they're expecting.
Yeah, it's a big part of why I like certain breweries. You know, it has the same, you know, je ne sais quoi taste, you know, and there's not that. That's really important. So back to your style. So you mentioned Belgian styles. Is there one of your Belgian style beers you'd like to give a shout out to? And perhaps is there any influence of your brewer in that or the yeasts or not?
Well, the hard part about Belgian styles is they just aren't super popular right now. They have their people for sure, and I'm one of them. But they don't have the mass appeal that others do, and English ales are the same way. Unless you're a specialist in it, you know, people aren't, you don't see a lot of, when you go to a local liquor store, you're not going to see a lot of English style beers. Unfortunately, those are two of my favorites, but, and we brewed, so we don't brew Belgians all the time. And we did, and when you brew a Belgian beer or any beer like that, you know, that's yeast strain specific, you know, we bring in a specific Belgian yeast strain to make the Belgian beers. You are committing to a run of beers because you want to keep using that yeast for the economics of it. You know, you don't want to do one and done with a pitch of yeast from the lab, because now you've added a lot of costs. And when you can harvest and repitch and reuse that yeast over, say, 6-7 beers, you know, you've now divided that cost by 6 into sellable beers. So when you commit to one Belgian, you're committing, at least for us, you're committing to probably 3 or 4 at least. So we brewed 3 right now is where we're at. We brewed a beer we do called Stubborn Monk, which is a Belgian double that I developed that I really like. And then we did a triple, Belgian triple, and then we did quad, Belgian quad or Belgian dark strong. And when he brewed those two, we hadn't really brewed Belgian since he got here. And I was really impressed with the quality, especially the quad. It's fantastic. And I told him that, and he's like, yeah, I really like, he told me, he's like, I really love to brew those kind of beers. I can brew them really well, but they don't, especially right now, the quad isn't, it's not exactly the time of year for Belgian quads, but we did it for our anniversary and we put some into barrels, but you know, that was something I did not, because it just never came up. So, you know, it was neat to see that he had a passion for that as well. It's just now trying to work it in, and, you know, you don't want to be sitting on it. So it's gotta be something you can sell.
You know, when I first started in the industry, like 30 years ago, it was good Belgian doubles and then triples that really got me going. And,
right,
you know, a good night out would definitely go from Belgian triple and probably end with a Belgian quad.
Yep.
And it, to me, that's why I started drinking beer. It wasn't, I never just drank beer to drink beer. And now I drink good beer.
Right. Absolutely. But, yeah, it was, same for me. It was one of the styles that definitely got me into it, and, or, you know, groups of styles. And I remember discovering Unibrew out of Canada and how good their Belgian styles were, and went, you know, that was probably one of those breweries that got me kind of in my mind going, I really would like to try to do this.
And then M, do you like Belgian style beers?
Absolutely. One of my true beer loves. I'll give a little shout out to Brews Beers in Denver, who make all Belgian beers. And I think that's such a feat in this day and age with Belgians not being incredibly popular. I think it's incredible that everything that they ferment is with Belgian yeast. And to Jason's point about being intentional about the use of yeast for flavor, I just love that estery, earthy component of Belgian yeast that is really hard to find in any other kind of a strain.
Wow, that's cool. Hey, we're going to close out soon, but Jason, I just want to talk about a thing I think is important for the industry. And whether you want to call it the talent pool or this, the rise of accreditations, it seems that I don't think enough people talk about, you mentioned that your brewer has a PhD in chemistry, or I'm seeing people advancing higher and higher with general knowledge programs like Cicerone.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the enough people are talking about the higher level of, you know, the talent that we have now in terms of training experience? I mean, right there, you blew me away with your brewer and his chemistry.
I think I have kind of mixed opinions. I think the Cicerone program is great. I think, you know, if you want to study that stuff, that's fantastic. Or things like BJCP, where you get certified as a beer judge. I think, for me, on the business or on the, you know, the brewery side of it, like I've discussed with our brewers, I feel like it's a little bit like in the wine world with, you know, becoming a sommelier and taking the master sommelier. Cicerone is really driven more towards the service and education of beer, not making it, and which is necessary and wonderful. But it doesn't necessarily make you a better brewer, other than you have an understanding. I've pushed my guys in production to that BJCP might be better, because if you that's where you really hit hard on the styles and the flavors that you're looking for in a good beer. But neither one, you know, that's one of the things. There is no, that I know of anyway, standardized for brewing. And part of that is we all do it differently, whether it's the equipment we have or the ingredients we have or the knowledge we have. You know, so it's, they're wonderful to do, and I applaud anybody who does them. Just don't think that that does it. You know, you should always be learning and always be looking to do better and understand more. You know, I'm more apt to see someone who has worked themselves up through three different breweries brewing and done, you know, created this beer and worked on this style and that over someone who, you know, who wants to tell me they're a, you know, a level one Cicerone. And I take that back to my background when I was in culinary, that I worked with guys from some of the best culinary schools in America. Some were fantastic. Some of them were, you know, couldn't cut a tomato. It doesn't give you the it gives you the information. It's what you do with it that matters. And I think that's key. You know, don't get a certification, because you really want to know everything you can. And it's part of the journey. I think that's the way, at least I see it. And, you know, having done this now 9 years, I am nowhere close to knowing everything I need to know. And that's part of what keeps me coming in every day, is there's just more to learn and more to understand, and things evolve and things change. So it's, that's part of the joy, is you get to just keep making yourself better and therefore making better beer.
All right. Listen, Jason and Em and Living the Dream Brewery in Littleton, Colorado, thanks so much for joining me on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to Armin Spengen, our engineer. And I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Thank you.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.